Hello there, this is Mick Fleetwood. I play in a band called Fleetwood Mac. Get that. And right now you're listening to Sound Sessions.
Hi, this is Michael with WGN Radio in Chicago. There's not much to say about our next guest. He's a living legend, drummer, and co-founder of Fleetwood Mac. I'm joined by Mick Fleetwood. Mick, how's it going today?
Oh, good. Busy at it, and happy to be here, and really happy to have attention paid to a not always very well known part of Fleetwood Mac's initial history.
Yeah, let's speak a little bit on that. You have the new book coming out. You're releasing the book Mick Fleetwood, Love That Burns: A Chronicle of Fleetwood Mac, Volume 1. And this chronicles, you know, the years before you really came to America and before you released Rumors, even 1967 to 1974. Genesis Publications. Make sure you check it out at fleetwoodmacbook.com. So what was the inspiration behind putting out this book? What's the connection?
Well, the connection actually, strangely enough, goes back a long way, way over 20 years ago, I'd imagine, is George Harrison was my ex-brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And Genesis had worked with George, and I saw this incredible book, which they're very special, the way they're put together. Not, it's high quality, the limited edition pieces of art, really. And I was so impressed with the way that they had put this gorgeous publication together. I went, oh, you know, my fantasy, oh, one day, you know. And then it sort of went off the radar. And about 2 years ago, maybe not quite as long as that, I was re-reminded when I saw a book that Genesis had done with Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Kells, who's out there, my nephew, I was with him out shopping or whatever we were doing. I picked the book up. I said, Kells, this is that, you know, the way to do it. It's that quality. And we literally got in touch with Nick and his family, who run the company, own the company, and said, would you like to do part one of Fleetwood Mac? Because that story is really, you know, not really that well known. In which was a reason I thought he wouldn't want to do it, you know. And they honored the whole process. Then, as we were doing it, truly had no pre-thought that we're entering into the 50-year anniversary of the original band, which was from 1967, mm-hmm. Yeah, August 1967, which is just about on us for 50 years. And so it became really relevant to a moment in time that's appropriately placed to present a journey back through through the early years, you know, of the band, going up to when I introduced John and Christine, when Bob Welch left the band. I, in a way, blundered upon, but was very impressed with an impromptu listening to Stevie and Lindsay, mm-hmm. in a studio, and before Bob left, actually. And I remember the music. It goes right up to that point, mm-hmm. where I introduce, in fact, at the end here, we went back to this El Carmen, this Mexican restaurant, and it's still there.
Yeah.
And this is where we stop, and where the hopeful pickup will be is the whole story from that point on until the present day. Mm-hmm. At some point in the future, hopefully, we'll put this all totally in order.
Mm-hmm. I see that. That's phenomenal. I mean, what a conversation. It kind of changed the face of music in a way.
Yeah, I mean, as people are influenced, any player that's been in this band, you know, certainly with this book, you're really blundering into the chess, mm-hmm. conversation that we were having. We were young chaps who, those were our heroes, like Rolling Stones, and they all, we all listened to. The Stones are a blues band.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they are, really, you know. And of course they've written fantastic stuff of their own, but back then that's exactly what we were, you know. But we got to work with people we never dreamt would ever be possible. Mm-hmm. And that's all featured in this book. And really, even I forget that we did all that stuff, you know.
It's been a while.
Yeah. And so it's quite revealing. And pictures are revealing in themselves, because mostly it's a pictorial book. Mm-hmm. With some, hopefully some halfway intelligent copy about what was going on. I've been able to work with my eldest daughter, Amelia, and then Kells, my nephew. So we've had this really good family, and I mean that with Genesis as well. We've become friends, really sweet people.
Yeah. Well, let's get right into that. You had mentioned Chess Records, and I was going to, you know, when I was taking notes for this interview, I was going to save that for the end, but I want to get right into the heart of it. You have an extremely close connection with Chicago and Chess Records.
Yeah.
How did this come to be? I mean, what was it like in those days being in Chicago at Chess Records and during the peak of it?
Well, if not at the peak, it was still very active.
Mm-hmm.
It was simply beyond any dream we could have ever had. And Mike Vernon, who headed up our record company, Blue Horizon, to his credit, put that all together. And the main reason I think it all came together was with the help and the focus of Willie Dixon, mm-hmm. the famous writer and bass player, and really the king of Chicago in many ways. Not only was a huge, impressive human being, just 6'5", I mean, just, and he was so helpful, and he put all, and he had recorded there, obviously, spent many sessions there, and he helped put all these fantastic, Buddy Guy was there, and Shaky Horton, J.T. Brown, Elmore James's sax player, and we really were we emulated Elmore James, so for us it was like, oh my god, I mean, Elmore was passed away by then, but
yeah,
playing, and that's all on those, it's Blues Jam at Chess, we made a record there, and full credit to Mike Vernon, who's featured in this book too, in terms mm-hmm. of talking about what was going on, and there's people like that were pioneers in England, bringing American blues, which is basically, at that point, in many ways, was a forgotten art form, mm-hmm. here. The irony of it was pitiful. So, and a lot of the guys would come to Europe, and we'd be such reverence for their music, and these are guys that couldn't even use a toilet properly in the United States back in the day. It's just like the irony of so many things turned around,
mm-hmm.
and looking back and what's come, not that we were sitting there being politically active, but the truth is that through our love for the music, it was worth a damn what actually happened, mm-hmm. which was seeing the read on what we actually did with our music actually did have an effect on people appreciating blues, you know. And it just took these funny bunch of, ostensibly a lot of crazy English dudes, mostly lads that loved American blues, that then took that back, we call it Coles to Newcastle, which is taking something where a lot of people, when we first started touring in the States, was simply not aware, especially young people, of anything. They thought it was just like a new art form coming from England, and at that point we were literally emulating and copying and playing a lot of the original songs which came out, that were recorded at that studio, and of course other places all over the States. So the very ironic triggering of that type of dynamic of what happened in the world of Fleetwood Mac. But that studio, it was mind-blowing for us,
mm-hmm.
to be in Chicago, in the Court of the Kings,
Yeah.
For us.
Did you come, you came from the UK to Chicago just to record the album?
Yeah. And just to record the album.
What was the draw? I mean, how do you even know, like, a place like Chicago to come there? Is it just because of the blues?
Because the legend.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Chess Records was legendary to us, the little lads in England. We would fawn over, like, these albums, and someone would have, like, a 45 or maybe some weird little tape on a dictaphone, like, you know, tape version of that.
Yeah.
Someone had taped something. Oh my God, you got that? And we'd have these get-togethers, and can I borrow it? And can I listen? That's how it all started. It was like a fraternity. So actually, to be literally in the court of the kings with the kings was beyond belief for us. You know, and happily, Peter Green and Jeremy, and I have to say, the band we've been able to discover some fairly unique recordings of Fleetwood Mac, not from Chess sessions, but from the early days that were going to come with this package. We made a double album. I'm wondering as we speak about whether, I think all the outtakes have eventually been made it out into a package now.
Mm-hmm.
But Fleetwood Mac was really blessed, especially with Peter Green, and Jeremy covered that whole Elmore James thing so well, and John McVie is such a brilliant blues player, bass player,
mm-hmm.
and this funny bunch of English lads. But listening to it, I remember, because we could have gone down in flames where it was just like these little punks from England and going like, you know, yeah, all right. Well, you know, who knows what the premise was. But I know Mike Vernon knew Willie Dixon at some reasonable level. And he's such a nice guy, as it turned out. So he got a lot of fellow players to turn up.
Mm-hmm.
And had we not delivered something fairly worthwhile, we would have known. Two, we wouldn't be talking about this. It would have been crashed and burnt. But the sessions were so, the energy that was going on, and Peter and Jeremy,
yeah,
as guitar players, and they were our lead players, you know, in the play of our music. They had, especially Peter, garnered unbelievable instant respect from these guys. And they go, like, a little white dude from England playing this shit.
I was going to say, there's some phenomenal photos in here of just like of these guys with shaggy hair and then these blues legends.
No, I know. And that's really becoming the main focus of what this book has been, with all the lovely kudos to everyone that's and other band members that come later on. We have paid attention to that. So I think it's really the story of what was it that started the flame,
mm-hmm.
you know, of Fleetwood Mac. And that was, we paid very, I paid more attention to it with all the respect to the other parts that are definitely there and should be spoken about and are featured for sure in the book. But that really triggered the whole thing and tells the story about who we were, although the Chess sessions were after the band was formed, not that long.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why we were Fleetwood Mac. We were a blues band. So it really puts a focus on the storytelling part of it, which is becoming a re-education even from I'm going like, wow, we really did that? You know? Mm-hmm. And like I said, you move on and you don't forget about it, but you don't really absorb what it was maybe was going on. And that's even fascinating for me. And I hope that's what this book does, and people go, wow, I never knew that. I never knew that about Fleetwood Mac.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of interesting.
You know, to be honest, I knew that you guys had come through Chicago a lot, and I did not know you had such a footing in Chicago's history like that. Yeah. Is there any, you know, possible interest in coming down to Chess Records, maybe implanting that footprint for the rest of history? Would you ever come down to Chicago and check out Chess again?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we had a loose conversation about when this book comes out.
I'm trying to lock you into it.
No. No, hey, it's up to them out there, the book company. But I instantly said that, you know, it would be great to come and by way of helping what's going on there. I'm very aware of the dilemma of saving... it was unthinkable that that would not exist, and I'm not suggesting that maybe is the case, but to actually have it a focus put on what that is, and before it's forgotten about, it's the same thing as I was talking about earlier in the interview, is that it is nice, great, nice, worthwhile thought process to know that we had at least something to do as a band to pay attention to American blues that was sort of being written off, really. No one would give a shit. Including many black American communities. Understandably, they didn't really want to be reminded of all the heartache of where they came from. That's what. But blues is more than that. Blues is history. Blues is has handed down a method for people in many, many, many different ways to express themselves, that it's okay to get shit out, you know, and that's hence the corny understanding of blues. But it's in the final analysis, it's not that corny. It's about expressing feelings, so it doesn't have to be. We were fascinated with the simplicity and the open expression, and the people, folks that were playing American blues in the early days, that it was disguised complaint. You know, it's like they played their way out because they knew if they sat on a street corner and spoke it out, it wouldn't have been good. And you know, that's the truth of the matter. They found a way to express something without being trodden on, quite frankly, and it was a fraternity, whether they as African American community were able to commune and say something without being persecuted, quite frankly, for what they were doing. So it's a fascinating thing, and anything that's going to perpetuate what people should know about, Americans should be really proud of it. And they basically, we had a lot of English musicians, just, and not to say devoid of, you know, even early Allman Brothers, and they're all, you know, Mike Bloomfield, and there's not like you didn't have people doing it here.
Yeah.
But the lion's share of attention, which was, has to be under the heading of, it's our pleasure that you know, when the Yardbirds came over here, and the Animals, and funky bands like that, and the Stones, way before we did, it was all spawned from American rock and roll and blues, you know. So Chess Records is one of the places that spewed out all this incredible music, and to see it not being preserved, and the heritage of the music, it would be absolute crime. So
truly,
it's a long-winded answer that I hope that maybe we can do something that would be relevant, you know, to what's part of this book. Who knows?
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting you say that, because when you're looking at music, especially in the last 20 to 30 years, a lot of sincerity, I mean, is lost. And you can really see that in blues musicians, especially coming from Chicago, that type of lyricism that they use is really just true to heart. I mean, do you find that to be the case? As far as, you know, the type of music that's around now, as far as, you know, maybe more electronic music, where's the heart, I guess I'm asking, you know, in music?
Well, I think that there is, and I understand what you're saying, but there's a lot of great music around. Sonically, you know, the hip hop, the whole, it's very produced. But what the good stuff has to, you have to go not so much to the instrumentalists, because it's more, there's a lot of looping and a lot of stuff that is least under the control mainly of a producer, and that it's a whole different art form of how it's put together.
Yeah.
But when you know, I mean, some of these the lyricists of some of the rap stuff, once you get away from, you know, the which I don't think is super great, is sort of degradation of women and gang banging and whatever. I think, you know, that's, to me, is a shame. But there's a huge amount of really astute sociological commentary going on that's really what you're listening for, and that is soulful. You know, that is someone that's found another way to get stuff out. So it's still under the blueprint of what blues is. Blues is about showing your feelings.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you write bad poetry at home, if you're enjoying it and it's heartfelt, that is worth a damn. You know, and you can really bend the rules, but it's under the premise of what I believe blues is mostly responsible for, which is, doesn't have to be the same, but there are essences, which was, if you're really expressing yourself, you're singing the blues, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
That's a good point. So we're speaking with Mick Fleetwood. Let's take it back to Chicago now, again, one more time. Blues is in our blood in the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
You were there recording in the 60s and 70s. What was it like in Chicago in the 60s and 70s, and where did you go to hang out? I mean, what were the streets like back then?
When we came to America, incorrectly, but we were so excited because of all the music. But the people go, like, you got to be really careful. You can't go down there. You know, you're white. You don't go there. Well, and it was probably for sure true. You could have got into a lot of trouble. When we went to Chicago, which was part of the Willie Dixon, you know, the dude was just amazing. We were chaperoned, you know, and he took Peter out. I actually wasn't there that night, but he took Peter out definitely to a place where no white folks would go.
Yeah.
Period. And but with Willie Dixon was a different story, and that's where Peter played the night away with Willie Dixon and his friends, and so we weren't really, but I think that the backdrop would be that certainly in the world that we wanted to know about, you know, you weren't probably advised to be hanging out in the places that we got to hang out. So the reality of that was that it, in a way, wasn't real, you know. It was protected or just it was made okay. We as young English lads were very unfairly, I think, oh, don't go out in the street in New York, you're going to get mugged. I go like, what?
A lot of fear. Yeah.
And that, you know, which is part of the world we're tending to live in now, which is not a good thing. Because it's never as bad as people, you know.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, come on. And so we had a great experience, and America has been nothing but great for this band, as we know. And somewhat ironically, a lot of people think Fleetwood Mac is an American band now. For good reason.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, for, you know, it's like we've lived here so long, and there's a lot of young people who go, oh, wouldn't even maybe put two and two together. But so now we're truly sort of, whatever the word is, from England and half American. But this is our home, and it's been a great place to be. And, but back then we were just passing through, and going back. It was like coming back, having visited, you know, Father Christmas up in Greenland, you know, coming back with all this experience.
Right.
Yeah. Not really believing it all happened. Mm-hmm. And then we put the album together, and I still look at that album and go, like, as with parts of this book, but you go, like, God. And we're really, really lucky that that all happened. And mostly it's an unknown story, so I hope some of that, for the history of a band that I've been in and all these lovely people that have been in Fleetwood Mac and still are in Fleetwood Mac, especially this book is it's not all written in yet, but my intro is going to be in there shortly. This is just a beginnings of what it's sort of going to be like.
It's a beautiful book too.
It is, it's already beautiful, but the kudos, I'm making very sure that people, it's not about me, I'm just a funny presenter of, but Peter Green started this band, and I want people to know that.
Absolutely.
And he's our mentor, and he needs that. He doesn't need anything, but I need to know that that's been done.
Yeah.
The kudos to that funny little band that started up.
I love it. You know, it must feel really good to look back at this book and all the hard work you put in. I mean, being in a band is like a family and a business at the same time.
Yeah, and sometimes a nightmare.
But it's all worth it in the end, right?
Well, hence the title. It's one of Peter's songs that he used to sing, and it's, if you ever hear it, you'll get it. It's heartbreaking and soulful, and it just struck me as, you know, that whole like the love affair, but it's the love that you know, it's love for sure, but a lot of it, you know, especially when you lose that situation, it hurts so bad, you know.
Yeah.
And part of that, there have been people that have not come out of the story of Fleetwood Mac in one piece, including Peter.
Yeah.
For some reason. And that would be love that burns, you know, and the flame is still going, you know.
Truly, truly a genuine title from such a genuine guy. That's The Love That Burns. You can pick up the book at FleetwoodMacBook.com. Mick, I could talk to you all day. I do get to ask you one.
We'll have to do the rest of it in Chicago.
Oh, absolutely. come by WGN anytime you want. Yeah. We'll get you in studio. We'll hang out. And then you and me can be part investors in Chess Records.
There you go.
So I got to ask you before I go. I spoke to my dad. He's a big Fleetwood Mac fan.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when I was young, we both sat down together and he goes, you need to see this band. And we watched Tusk together when you had the USC marching band on the
Lunacy
DVD.
Yeah.
And he wanted to know, you know, what was the idea behind that, the concept? Who came up with that and how awesome was it when you saw that band come out and everyone just lose their
mind?
It's
always awesome. And fairly recently, I did that drum off thing with that movie star, what's his name? With the guy from the Foo Fighters.
Oh, yeah.
It's famous movie star. It does this drum battle thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I went and did that and had the USC marching band come on so I'd win the competition. You know, we were shredded.
That's one way to do it.
That was a lot of, with Dr. Bartner, their musical director. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of fun. In brief form, we were in the middle of making an album and we had a break. I went, my father at that point had fairly recently passed away, and mum was with my sister in France. My sister had a place up in Normandy. So I went, mm-hmm. and to be with mum and just hang out for a bit. And while I was there, the first night, I drank myself into a stupor, and in the morning I'd go like, what the hell's that? It was a brass band going around the village, it was Saturday, and they kept going around, mm-hmm. and about 20 minutes later they come around, get louder, and it would be right outside my window. Ooh. And I had such a bad hangover, and I'm like, oh man. And I couldn't sleep, so I went, okay, I just started drinking again, sat out on the balcony, and I thought, how cool is that? It was like the Pied Piper, that kids were joining in, and people in wheelchairs being wheeled around, and old sailors in the front that drank too much and their legs were falling off or whatever. And that's where I just got this funny idea, because Lindsay had recorded part of the track, and it sort of, from my recollect, had been pretty much relegated to the dustbin. And while I was away, I got this idea, what if we put this massive marching band of playing that riff, because it sounds like a carnival thing, you know.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. And anyhow, that's where I got the idea. So one time, for sure, it paid off getting drunk. and we it's been a legendary song, actually. And then I came with this idea to record it in Dodger Stadium. Everyone thought I was insane, which I was. I said, well, we're going to do it. And then Ron Say, the Penguin, known as the Penguin, of course, John McVie has a penguin tattooed on his arm, and that used to be our emblem as a penguin. And one of our office secretaries knew Ron Say. And she said, I'll get Dodger Stadium for nothing. And we did. And it became, we bussed all the band in. We had like 200 musicians and recorded that song in Dodger Stadium. And I played the Tusk many times out in the field there with the boys and the girls. So that's how that happened. Just came together with a crazy idea that in a way paid off, and that was my contribution to that song that Lindsay wrote.
What a beautiful story. Truly one of, you know, the music that you write really just reflects a lot of my own experiences in life.
Me too, for a lot of other people's music, like the stuff we've been talking about. It's a powerful medium, and then there are others, as we know, certainly, in many ways, for, you know, slightly obvious reasons, music pretty much, you know, has a grip on being at the top of the bill for infiltrating people's psyche and memory triggers and stuff. It's pretty true that mostly does. Occasionally there'll be major parts of history, which of course aren't always good, and sometimes they are, and people remember those things. But music has this pervasive, long-term, the outcome is that you pretty much say, well, music seems to just be this backdrop very often to people's lives. And it just is. And you know, a great book can do the same thing, but the reality is, I think I'm correct in saying, just it's not as pervasive as music has been throughout all time. It's been the messenger of people's feelings and troubadouring into people's lives and becoming part of a fabric, really. And they all own different memories that you trigger. And I could sit with, you know, it's great sitting here with you, and you, I'm never bored with hearing. We do forget that part, you know. Imagine how the Beatles, you know, and Bob Dylan, who really sit there and have social commentary that's affected huge, profound statements. We've never been a band that does that, but we still have, it's other people's memories becomes their interpretation of what you've triggered, and it's all meaningful. You know, so it's been a great journey.
It's been a great journey. It's been a great time talking to you. I'm really looking forward to when you come over to Chicago and hang out.
Amen.
Mick, thanks again for joining us at the WGN.
Can't get enough of Sound Sessions? Like our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter @SoundSeshPod and check us out on Instagram @SoundSessionsWGN.